Session number 10923, reel 15.
Mr. Harold Harper, reel 15. What happened when the battery of the regiment arrived then?
Well,
Felixstowe.
Well, they were immediately shown to their billets, which incidentally was the Melrose Hotel, which had been converted for army purposes. Very, very quickly sent on leave, for 3 weeks' leave, actually, which they'd thoroughly earned. Whilst we in the advance party, having had a fortnight's leave, we had to stay and look after the place again over Christmas and the New Year. And it was not until about the middle of January that everybody was back again in Felixstowe to take up the cudgels, so to speak. Having said that, we suffered somewhat during our stay at Felixstowe, in as much as the relaxation of being back in England, being amongst the beer and skittles and what have you, caused a certain lack of, not necessarily discipline amongst themselves, but certainly discipline when we came to go on the firing ranges again. Because towards the end of January, we went on a firing weekend, if you like, or 3 nights, near Hunstanton. And quite frankly, there were a number of errors which ought not to have happened.
What kind of errors?
Well, people putting the wrong charge into the gun and firing short and all that sort of thing. This was, I'm sure, the result of this sort of relaxation in the atmosphere which was about the battery at the time. It was about the middle of February when we learned that we were being
when you joined with the 16th.
When we were being reformed, that's right. That the regiment was being reformed, and that we were,
there'd been efforts to get this going in the background.
In the background, which we...
Were you aware of that?
No, not particularly, no. I know that Major Ivor Birkin was the instigator. He had links with one of Winston Churchill's aides. And consequently, we were reformed into a regiment in the middle of February. I think it was about the middle of February, with the 16th Medium, having taken one battery from the 16th Medium and the other battery going to the 7th Medium. And whereas the 7th Medium Regiment stayed in Felixstowe, we were moved down to Brighton to join.
How did you feel about this? Were you pleased?
At the time, I had a sort of a... I was torn with my loyalties, because obviously I knew a lot of work had been put into getting our regiment back again, so to speak, but on the other hand, we'd made a lot of friends with members of the 7th Medium Regiment, and we had become, if I may say so, a quite efficient fighting unit, and it seemed a pity really to break that fighting unit up.
Was that a common view amongst them?
Yes, that was, in fact, quite a few people resented the move. For the simple reason that the Nottingham contingent had roughly disappeared at Knightsbridge anyway. By the time we came to February 1944, I would doubt if there were above 50 Nottingham people left, quite frankly. Anyway, we got over it.
It wasn't as popular a move as... Oh,
it wasn't. No. We didn't go outside cheering or anything like that. It was just... In fact, amongst one or two people, there's quite a fair amount of resentment. I think Ivor Birkin would have been very upset had he been aware of that, quite frankly, because I'm sure he'd worked very, very hard. Certainly, the outcome of it all was, I mean, we were all very, very happy eventually. But because we made some quite good friends in the 16th medium. And as I say, we moved down to Brighton.
So according to the regimental history, you got down to Brighton on the 19th of March.
Ah, well, that would be it then. So we probably knew about towards the end of February, and then we actually moved down to Brighton in March.
And what was the situation in Brighton? Did you stay with B Troop as the troop?
Yes, yes, I did.
So you'd be in 425 battery then, as it was reconstituted?
That's right. 425 battery reconstituted B Troop, Sergeant Major, that's right, yes.
So you weren't in 426 anymore?
No.
426 was the C&D Troop.
That's right.
How did you mix in with the 16th?
Well, obviously, we were all in one sergeant's mess, for one thing, so we all got to know each other very well there. We found it's rather strange, in as much as we were seasoned soldiers, having seen a lot of enemy action, whereas we were with a bunch of chaps who all they'd done was drill on the square. There's a bit of ribaldry went on, but people like I for one, tried my utmost to sort of give these people, you know, make them feel at home, so to speak. Because obviously they were the underdogs, really. But they turned out to be quite a good bunch of lads. No doubt about that.
So they were up to the standard you needed to.
Oh yes, I mean the gun drill and everything was very, very good. Probably better than ours, because I mean we'd let a lot of things go by the board in action, which you know you learn on the square certain things, but when you get in action, you sort of okay. They're always at the back of your mind. But you do the thing just all that little bit better, really. Yeah.
So there was no friction between the two groups?
No, none whatsoever, no. I think the officers were split around sort of generously, if you like, to make sure that nothing like that happened. I think the thing settled down fairly well. I think we got one or two sports going and things like that, yeah. We had a bit of a rugby match, and
what about you got equipped with a new set of guns? There were 5.5s again.
5.5s, yes, oh yes.
And what condition were they in? Cause,
they were, you know, in the good condition they were. But by that time, of course, the 5.5 was in full production, I presume, in the factories in England. As I'd pointed out, we got the first batch. At Alamein, yes. So, anyway.
How did you spend the time then in the Brighton area leading up to the D-Day and afterwards?
We did a fair amount of manoeuvring around the countryside. Obviously, it was not an area where you could go out firing. We moved into Brighton occasionally for the evening. See a few shows and what have you, a few dancers, met a few wrens, but it was fairly short-lived actually that stay, because I think we, in April, we moved into the Bradford area, which is, for the record, where I met my wife, and she was in the ATS up in Bradford. And of course in that area we were able to get out on Ilkley Moor, Blubberhouse Moors, and do a fair amount of manoeuvring, and we were there actually just before D-Day.
Did you, the slackness that you mentioned that was sort of crept in, you know, when you first got back to England, Was it fading out again?
Yes, by now that had faded out. By the time we were, by the time sort of April, May came round, we were back to something like it. It was only natural that we should have this sort of slackness, which after being out there 4 years, I mean, it was obvious relaxation. Yeah.
So the standards have been...
The standards came back again. We had to do, when once we joined 16th Medium, we really had to show that we were a fighting unit and not just a bunch of gadabouts, so to speak.
And the integration by the time D-Day came, had that been completed?
Oh, yes, that had been completed by the time D-Day came, yes.
So you were one unit then?
Well, one unit, yes, I've no doubt about that.
There was a parade in Nottingham on the 13th of May.
That's right.
Do you remember that at all?
Oh, yes, most definitely, of course, because, I mean, I was sort of coming home, which was very, very important. Yes, there was a good turnout of the local population, and of course, we'd been well presented in the press over the Knightsbridge jump and what have you. And we got pretty well looked after.
You enjoyed it then?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The regiment was genuinely popular in Nottingham then?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Always has been. Still is. Yeah.
So, what do you remember about the actual preparations for the invasion? I mean, you weren't going over straight away.
No, we didn't go over straight away. We were all expected to, but we realised that... with our very, very heavy equipment, there was no way we could go over with the initial invasion, because we knew full well that you don't sort of throw 7.5-ton guns and 10-ton matadors onto invasion barges. But nevertheless, we were very ready to go.
You were waiting near Brighton, weren't you?
No, near Bournemouth.
Near Bournemouth.
Near Bournemouth, Ringwood to be exact. And that's... we were all... been waterproofed.
What did that involve?
And that involved making sure, Frank, that all plugs on lorries were all sort of sealed. Consequently, by the time you'd sealed everything, the vehicles were unable to travel more than about 2 miles. The idea being that once you got the other side, you whipped all the sealing off.
Why could they only travel? I'm not very technical.
Yes, well, I'm not particularly, but I presume because of the fact that no air was getting to the various parts of the engine. And obviously the idea was we would probably be driving through water. Consequently, because all the vehicles were waterproof, we got nothing with which to sort of nip into Bournemouth or anything like that, so we were literally sort of confined to camp. And we were in a state of readiness all the time.
Was there any secrecy, Were you told to keep quiet immediately before...
Well, we knew something was afoot, obviously, because of the concentration of troops on the south coast. I mean, it was obvious that having been whipped down from Bradford to Bournemouth, that something was afoot. And we were whipped down to Bournemouth, incidentally, at about 2 hours' notice. And that was a bit of a hair-raising experience to get everybody together. Well, I think it was a Sunday evening. And to get them out of Bradford and in the small hours of the morning was a job that, you know, every sergeant major one time in his life has to undertake.
How did you go about it?
Oh, rounding people up. It was knocking at doors and goodness knows what. People sleeping out. Yes, it was quite an experience that was. Anyway, we've managed to get them all together. Yes, when we were down in near Bournemouth, we had to be in a state of readiness all the time. I suppose the powers that be sort of knew this, and you know, they put us in when they thought it was necessary. Ah, and of course when the transport was available. This is another problem, I suppose, really.
So what happened when you actually went? You went in July, didn't you?
Yes, well, we went very early in July, and I think we went from Millwall Docks. That was an experience, because by that time they started dropping these V2s. One or two dropped amongst the docks, down the Barking Road, as it was called. That was an experience. Not one I'd like to.
The V1s or the V2s?
The V1s, the doodlebugs. Yeah. But being on that boat was a funny experience, quite frankly. It was one of these that had been sort of adapted to take troops, and very quickly adapted, because the toilet facilities were non-existent, and that sort of problem. Just a sort of a tin thing that shot over the side, so to speak, you know, which is very primitive, really. We were fortunate in as much as we didn't get very wet when we got off, and of course I'm quite happy for me to go abroad now. Yes, we dropped into action the first night we were there, which meant by that time our troops had only got about 5 miles inland anyway. There was this terrific battle going on for Caen.
So you landed on the 14th of July, I think.
That's right. That's
Was it when you got ashore? You say you didn't get wet. Did you take the waterproofing off, or did?
Yes, immediately took the waterproofing off as soon as we got ashore, and we were completely mobile again then.
And then you were rushed inland.
Yes, we were.
Yes,
because as I say, the lads had a bit of a difficult job. They got above 5 miles inland, quite frankly. We didn't seem to be going very, very far before we were in action. Mind you, so this battle for Caen lasted 2 or 3 weeks. It was towards the end of July before Caen was released.
What positions did you take up, do you remember?
We were in an orchard, but from a personal angle, we hadn't been. Can I get back to 16th medium again? Because when we first went into action, obviously you've got this little bit of tension amongst the newcomers, and we really, we had to prop them up somewhat. As troop sergeant major, I got two new sergeants who come from 16th medium, and I had to make sure they were well and truly sort of backed up, to give them a bit of confidence.
How would you go about that?
Just issuing words of praise. You know, probably the odd gimmick, if you like. But certainly urging them on, and, you know, calling the Germans all the names under the sun, and that sort of thing.
Did they respond well?
Yes, one lad buckled under, unfortunately. There's about three senior ranks in the 16th medium, we were buckled under. The battery sergeant major and two sergeants, who sort of, I think they found it too much, quite frankly.
And they'd been from the 16th?
As a result of one of them going, I was moved from Troop Sergeant Major B Troop to Battery Sergeant Major of 426.
426?
Yeah, that's right. Early in the campaign. So I really then got a majority of my chappies then was 16th Medium.
Like so you actually switched from 425
to 426. So the majority of my lads then were 16th medium lads.
This was during
during the Caen battle. Yeah.
And what was the situation when you took over? I mean, how was 426 battle?
I despaired quite frankly because I found, for example, that the sergeant major was operating as if he was still on Salisbury Plains, and there was about 15 rounds of gun per 15 rounds of ammunition per gun. The battery I'd just left, I'd left 250 rounds per gun. In other words, we looked upon 15 rounds of gun as disastrous. I mean, we always had a great supply. So I remember the very first, within 10 minutes of looking at the situation, I got the complete echelon to go back 5 or 6 miles to the ammunition depot and load up. And I think they were quite shaken actually, because I think they all thought they were in for a nice easy time. And I sent them out in the middle of the night to go and get loaded up, and then they dumped all the rounds early the following morning. And from then we were all right. Yeah.
Any other problems when you arrived?
None whatsoever, I think. I endeared myself to most. I think by then I knew most of the chappies anyway. Yeah.
So it was the main problem that was bequeathed to you was this ammunition, lack of
the ammunition. The lack of sort of fighting experience, if you like. Yeah.
And what exactly was your role, would you say? As you've told me what you did as troop...
Well, the battery sergeant major, you had two troop sergeant majors to sort of call on, and so consequently you talked with them about the different things, and also you've got your own, you're in responsible then for the echelon, which include all the motor mechanics, the gun fitters, the ammunition trucks. All those were your responsibility, and I suppose generally the general morale of the battery.
And in this, you were assisted by the troops.
And what one had to do was to make sure, for example, that at least once per day, you went into the forward positions and mixed with the lads to show that. You just weren't sitting back, so to speak. And then if there were any problems in the troops, you tried to iron them out for them, you know.
But people talk to you normally, or were you too high rank for people?
Oh no. You made yourself available.
Yeah. Now what about, that's with the men and, you know, the other senior NCOs. What about
the officers?
The officers. How did you have to link in with them?
Oh, linked in with them. I think they were, in general, most of them were 16th medium officers, and I think they were probably, I might sound a little bit sort of egoistic here, but I think they were probably pleased to see someone with some battle experience in a fairly vital position. It all went reasonably well from there anyway.
What would you say their role was as officers then, as compared to your role as senior NCO?
Oh, well, they, in all fairness, they gave the instructions. I mean, they made the final decisions. But they weren't afraid occasionally to come and ask the Sergeant Major's opinion. And I wasn't afraid at times to voice my opinion if I thought something was wrong.
So you'd use your experience to give advice when necessary.
Oh, yes. Well, I did one or two things off my own bat, which no one seemed to disapprove of her.
And who were your officers at that time? Because Barber arrived just after Kane, I think.
Yeah, that's right, he did. Bill Barber, of course, knew me from way back. I had a battery captain to whom I was mainly responsible, Captain Lee Smith.
What was he like?
He was, by profession, a vicar. And he was not the easiest chappy to get on with. Merely, not because he was offensive, but because he dithered, quite frankly. He dithered too much for me. I think it was lack of experience. Yeah.
Any other officers?
See, if you're not careful, what the question you're asking is how I found. You see, when you were used to certain officers who you'd been with for a number of years, and been able to judge them and see their value, if you like, and then find yourself with a bunch of chappies who hadn't had any experience, it was, if you weren't careful, you were drawing comparisons, and I think that was unfair. Yeah.
So what do you remember of the fighting that came?
Well, it was very intense, no doubt about that. It was probably one of the most difficult battles that we ever encountered. We got sorted out on one or two occasions. One of my troops suffered quite some casualties one evening.
What from?
From enemy shelling. We were in an orchard just outside Caen, we got well and truly sorted out. They hit an ammunition wagon, and of course, having all these shells were exploding all over the show, and literally one or two people got very badly injured or killed. And so that was a traumatic night, sorting that problem out.
Was there more counter battery fire from the Germans?
In the early stages of that campaign, until the real breakthrough came at Falaise later, the German counter battery stuff was very, very good.
It was more than you'd been used to in your previous campaigns?
No, counter battery in Tobruk was the worst we had, because we were pinned down there. They knew exactly where we were in Tobruk, because we had no room for manoeuvre, whereas here, okay, the only right reason we hadn't got much room for manoeuvre is because we were still on this sort of wide bridgehead, if you like, off the on the Normandy coast, and I suppose there were so many troops there that we didn't get much chance to move about in the early stages, but of course we were given more space later. After the breakthrough at Caen, we still had a fair number of battles, and of course there came the battle of what they call the Falaise Gap.
Hang on a minute. How did fighting differ in Normandy? What was the nature of fighting in Normandy? Because people, the sort of fighting.
Yes, it was different altogether, really, from what we'd been experiencing in the desert. This business of having to keep to roads, having civilian population to worry about, something we'd never encountered before. The fact that you just couldn't drive anywhere, whereas in the desert you could, unless you were stupid enough to go into a deep sand. But the fact that you sort of were restricted to a certain extent of where you went. Not that we were bothered about going over ploughed fields or anything like that, but it was ditches and rivers and goodness knows what else that we'd never been used to.
What about observation? Was that more of a problem? I know that wasn't your side of things.
No, observation, no, it wasn't. But by then, we got the Auster aircraft spotters, artillery spotting. We did a fair amount of shooting from that for the first time. I don't think it had been tried out on Salisbury planes, I believe, but I think we were involved in the first sort of air spotting exercise. But as you say,
was the observer one of yours?
Yeah.
An observator. So
we sent a captain, one of our captains, up in the aircraft to do the spotting. Spotting on the ground was another problem. Of course, you've got to get it into a hill position to be able to observe. And
the Germans were just less visible. They're being hedges and such.
Oh yes. The biggest tragedy of the whole setup, of course, was when they went in with the what they call low-level bombing, and there was this catastrophe which was talked about in Whitehall for many weeks afterwards, whereby the first plane in, the